Hello, everybody. You are on the fifth day of Smartest 2008 and the third day of our keynote presentations. We've had Molly Gordon and Allison Stanfield so far, and now we're going to have Attorney Leonard Duboff with us. Attorney Duboff, are you here?
I'm here.
Great. I'm so glad you could make it. My goodness. You are right in the middle of a trial.
Yes, and in fact, the jury is still out. And that actually raises an interesting question. I'm going to talk about copyright and trademark, but I would like to begin by talking about some of the issues involved in this case, because they're very relevant to all of your audience.
Wonderful. Let me just first mention that Leonard Duboff is one of the pioneers of the field of art law and a founding member of the law firm, the Duboff Group Law, which represents museums, galleries, dealers, photographers, artists, and craftspeople. He's also written numerous books on art law, which we will post on our Hot List of Books webpage we're getting ready to put up. I also have a couple questions. So where would you like to start with the case today?
Well, let me hear the questions, and then I'd like to make some points that are really important for all professional artists and craftspeople.
Great. Okay. This one comes from an artist who said that this artist is also a manager for another artist and does things such as copyright, but wonders if it would be a good idea to add themselves as a legal representative into the copyright, or better that the artist be the unique owner of the copyright.
Well, I would recommend that the artist be the unique owner of the copyright, unless this person is somehow related to the artist, because relationships, as we know in today's world, are fleeting. They break up, and it may be difficult down the road if the relationship breaks up for the artist to clear the record and get all rights back. So I would recommend that the artist retain rights and work out whatever arrangement is going to be made with this person outside of the official record.
Great. And then the second one has to do with the fact that, you know, we have about six countries, I think, represented in our artist group right now, the Netherlands and Australia and Germany. And so this question came about how the copyright law works internationally, and is there different ones for different countries, or is there some international copyright law that you can take across borders?
Excellent question. Every country has its own copyright law. However, there are three multinational treaties that the United States and all of the countries you just identified belong to. The oldest of these treaties is called the Berne Convention. It was written in Berne, Switzerland. It's about a century old, and it provides reciprocal rights for copyright owners in all member nations. It actually provides, in addition to that, certain other rights, so-called rights of moral rights, rights of protecting the integrity of the work. And it was for that reason that the United States resisted becoming a party to Berne until the late 80s. At that time, we finally did realize that artists do have a connection with their work, which is different from a connection that a manufacturer would have with a truck or Jeep. And artists have greater rights. And so we did enact the Visual Artists' Rights Act of 1990, which I was privileged to assist in drafting for Senator Kennedy of Massachusetts. That gave the artists in the United States greater integrity rights in their work. Once we drafted that and had that as part of American law, we were in a position to join the Berne Union. So under the Berne Convention, you have reciprocal rights in about 50-some-odd countries.
Oh, that's incredible. How can we find out the 50 countries that participate?
Well, if you go on uscopyrightoffice.gov, it has a list of the countries. The second treaty that the United States is a party to is called the Universal Copyright Convention. That was the treaty that we actually drafted and promulgated when we wouldn't become a party to Berne. And there are a number of countries that are members of the it's referred to as the UCC. Again, if you comply with the copyright laws of your home country, if your home country is a party to the Universal Copyright Convention, if you use the international copyright symbol, the C within a circle, then you have reciprocal rights in UCC countries, and there are a number of UCC countries. And then within this hemisphere, we have the Buenos Aires Convention. Under the Buenos Aires Convention, if you comply with the copyright laws of your country, and if you add the legend, all rights reserved, that's what that means, in the official language of your country, in our country it's English, you'll see it in Spanish or Portuguese, then you have protection under the Buenos Aires Convention. Between the three treaties, we have reciprocal rights with about 135 countries of the world. And so you have reciprocal rights in those nations, so you must, in all cases, comply with the copyright law of your own nation.
Okay, great. I just want to make sure that people who've jumped on, if you have joined us, we are on the fourth day of Smartest 2008 and the second day of our keynote presentation, and we're just starting off with our last keynote speaker today, Leonard DeBoff, on the field of art law. Okay, go ahead. You wanted to talk about the trial that you are involved
in
right now.
Well, one of the key issue, one of the most important issues in this trial, which is a lesson to all of your listeners, is make sure that you have a good contract written in unambiguous language which covers exactly what you intend and the other party intends, and that you have a good paper trail. Involved in this case is a consignment arrangement, which unfortunately is ambiguous. There are two different versions. An employment contract, which is not clear as far as which state law would govern because there are two different states involved, what the compensation is to be paid, what the arrangements were, what the obligations of the employee are. It unfortunately is an exercise in what can go wrong will go wrong if you're not careful. And it's a good lesson in make sure your contract is clear, unambiguous, covers what you intended, and that you and the other parties to that contract agree. If you have an oral contracts are enforceable, but unfortunately oral contracts aren't worth the paper they're written on. That is to say, proving them is difficult. If you have an oral contract, then it is a very good idea to write a letter, memorandum, email, something, confirming the terms of that oral contract and asking the other party to get back to you promptly if that is not consistent with their understanding of the agreement. You at least have some evidence of what the contract is. And under a body of law which has been adopted in all states of the United States and many other countries called the UCC, which is in this case a different UCC. This is the Uniform Commercial Code. If you're dealing with goods and artwork is goods, and if both parties are merchants, professionals, and an artist is a professional and a dealer is a professional, a memorandum sent in confirmation of a contract, confirming that this is our oral arrangement, is as good as if it was signed by both parties and you have your written contract. Regrettably, in the case I'm now involved in, the parties didn't do this. And so both sides are having to present to a jury what they believe their deal was. Both sides are trying to convince the jury that their deal was, in fact, what was agreed upon. And both sides are having a devil of a time because they're so different. This is a real example of what can happen when you're not careful with your documentation.
Okay, that's great. It's great to know that being clear and making sure the documentation is passed between parties and confirmed in some form that can be then reproduced doesn't necessarily have to be a contract that you go to a lawyer for.
Well, no. However, I can tell you, if you've heard the commercial, pay me now or pay me later, it's a very good idea. If you're not skilled in drafting, if you're not experienced, it's a very good idea to have somebody who is skilled in drafting, go through and make sure it really does say what you intend it to say. It really does cover what you intend it to cover. It really will stand up if challenged. And there are a number of things that you really want to have a professional deal with. And while lawyers do charge for their time, it's far better to pay a few dollars at the beginning and have the arrangement put in place properly than to wind up in litigation. I've been on trial now for 2 weeks in this case, and we are still not finished. It's far cheaper, far easier, far less painful to do it right the first time.
Right. And I have a question about that. If you're going to be choosing a lawyer and you're dealing in a field that's very specific, like art, do you really need to find a lawyer who's specifically aware of that field, or will a general lawyer still be able to do basic things like contracts?
I would recommend using a specialist for a couple of reasons. While a specialist may be a little more expensive, you're not paying that person to learn the field. And in most fields, there are language usages which are common in the field, understood in the field, and consistent with the field. A general practitioner may or may not know that. Second, if you have a lawyer who is experienced in your field, who is a specialist, that lawyer will know what is required rather than guessing and finding out perhaps down the road that they didn't cover all of the issues. So it's like going to a doctor. Do you go to a general family practice doctor, or do you go to a specialist when you have a particular problem? You're going to be far better served by having a specialist who knows that problem deal with it than going to a general practitioner who may or may not be able to cover the issue.
And this is a really basic question, but if an artist were needing to find a lawyer who was steeped in art law, is there a place they could go to find the names of those lawyers they might speak with?
So like, well,
are they collected in one place, like on the website, for example?
There really isn't. There's no one directory of art lawyers. What I would do is Google art law and try and find somebody who has some expertise in the field, see who's written articles and books, who has some expertise. And that's basically how I would go about trying to find the person to assist me. In our case, we have clients literally all over the world because we do specialize in this area, and we've been doing it for a long time.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right, I'm going to let you...
Looking at the area of copyright, how do you protect the integrity of your work? And copyright is a very interesting doctrine. In the United States, it actually goes back to the very foundation of our nation. The United States Constitution actually deals with copyright. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8 of the U.S. Constitution, which was written when we became a nation, gives Congress the power to create a copyright law in this country. And the first Congress did just that. And the reason copyright has been at the beginning of our country is when we first started, we were the third world. We were backwards, and Europe was sophisticated, the manufacturer who took our raw materials and converted them into products that they'd sell back to us at a significant markup. We were culturally backwards. They had all the culture and sophistication, museums, etc. And so in order to give our people an incentive to catch up with the more sophisticated, more mechanized Europeans, Congress created a copyright law for creating art, literature, music, and the like, and adopted a patent law so that we could catch up with them mechanically. And we've had both bodies of law in this country since the very beginning. They've evolved, they've changed. The copyright law we're functioning under now is the Copyright Revision Act of 1976 that was effective on January 1st, 1978. It's been amended several times since then, but that is still the body of law we look to for copyright protection. And that law is very user-friendly. It's very user-friendly. Under the copyright law, of the United States, and many countries follow this. In fact, we patterned ours after many of the European countries. They did lead us in this regard. The Statute of Anne in England was really the first copyright law in the world. Under our copyright law, whenever any original work of authorship, which has some minimal creativity, is put in a tangible form, it is automatically protected by copyright. You need do nothing else. It's automatically protected. So original work of authorship, your writing, drawing, painting, sculpture, etc., when it's put in a tangible form, it can't be conceptual. It has to be tangible. It's automatically protected by copyright. But that's a copyright with rubber teeth. That's a copyright which needs some additional elements in order to really make it do what you want it to do. With that copyright, if somebody, for example, relies in good faith on the fact that you didn't give them fair warning that your work was protected and copies the work believing it's in the public domain and freely copyable, they're known as innocent infringers. Under the law, innocent infringers may not be held liable for damages and may be permitted to continue copying. At worst, they could be held liable for $200 worth of damages. Not very appealing. So you want to give fair notice. We believe in this country in fair notice, or what we call due process. How do you do that? Well, you basically mark the work, copyright, your name, and the year when it was first published or first made available to the public. And as I said, if you use the international copyright symbol instead of the word copyright, the little C in a circle, you then have gotten protection under the Universal Copyright Convention as well. So you have international protection by virtue of doing that. So now you've given fair notice, and you, under the statute, will prevent somebody from claiming the defense of innocent infringer, claiming that they are innocent infringers. That's good. But that's still not the whole answer. Many of you have heard about registering a copyright and all of that. Do you have to do the registration to get a copyright? Absolutely not. There's really only three times you must register the work. First, you cannot sue for copyright infringement in the United States unless and until you register the copyright in the work. So if somebody infringes your work after it's been published and sold, and you hadn't registered it, before you can actually go to court, you must register the copyright.
So can you register when you know somebody's going to, can you wait until you know somebody might, you need to sue somebody to do that?
Well, you certainly can, but that's not a good idea, and you'll see why in a moment. The second time you must register is when the register of copyright, that's the person who's the head of the copyright office, realizes that you have copyrighted work out there and they want you to register, they'll send you a letter saying register. You must register then or you can be fined. And the third time that you must register is, and this one's rather moot at this point, under the statute, if you inadvertently published a work without notice and wanted to correct it, under the old law, you had to have a notice on the work. You had to, as part of that correction process, register. That one's not as important. The first two are the most important. Here's why I think registering the work before a problem arises is important. If somebody infringes your copyrighted work, you can sue for infringement, and that's good. That gives you protection. And if you sue for infringement, there are remedies available. The remedies are, you can get actual damages if you can prove them. Actual damages are either what you lost and could prove with some particularity you lost because of the infringement, or you can sue for the infringer's profit. You can get either of those remedies. You can also get an order requiring that all infringing copies of the work be destroyed, and an order preventing future infringement. However, if and only if the work was registered before the infringement occurs, you can also recover in lieu of actual damages, instead of actual damages, statutory damages of no less than $750, no more than $30,000, and if you can establish that the infringement was willful or intentional, up to $150,000, and this is probably the most important, you can recover back your reasonable attorney's fees that you incurred in the litigation. So, somebody infringes your work, and it wasn't registered. You have to prove with particularity that their infringement resulted in you losing something. There's a case on this. When Gerald Ford was president, he wrote a book about his presidency, and it was published after he left office. The publisher sent review copies of that book out to a number of magazines, and this is pretty typical, before the book was actually on the market. And the reason they do that is so that the reviewers will review it and that the book reviews will come out at around the same time that the book is actually on the market. Gerald Ford had also contracted with Time magazine to sell the serialization rights, the first serialization rights of his book. And he had contracted with Time magazine for them to pay him a significant amount for those first serialization rights. A publication called The Nation got the review copy, and instead of reviewing it and writing a book review, they published a serialized version of the book without permission. Gerald Ford sued, and he was able to prove that because they, The Nation, infringed by publishing the first serialization of his book, Time magazine canceled the contract saying it's too late. We can't publish the first serialization. It's already been done. We're not paying you. He proved with particularity what he lost. That's a highly unusual case. Your profits. You can recover, the infringer's profits. You can recover the infringer's profits, but if you catch the infringer early on, there's not going to be very many profits in addition. A copyright case is federal. You have to file in federal court and pay a lawyer to file in federal court, very formalistic and very expensive proceeding. Is it going to be economically worth your while to pay a lawyer to file a case in federal court if you caught the infringer pretty early on and your profits are minimal? You're going to spend more in legal fees than you're going to be able to recover in damages. So unless you're registered before the infringement and can recover back attorney's fees, it's not going to be cost effective. In most cases, it's not going to be cost effective.
So when you say register, you're talking with the Copyright Office, correct?
Yes, and the registration process is very simple. If you go on www.uscopyright.gov or copyright.gov, they have forms. You pick the appropriate form, and for art, it's VA, Visual Arts. You download the form. You fill it out. You send the form in with two copies of your work. And you only need one copy if it's sent in before the work is actually published or distributed to the public. You pay the filing fee, which is $45, and it's registered. Now, if you are prolific and do a lot of work, that could be a pretty expensive process.
You just anticipated my next question.
Particularly, for example, if you're a photographer and you shoot thousands of shots.
Or even if you're a painter and you produce, you know.
Well, exactly. It's going to be expensive.
5 or 6 things a week, yeah.
The Copyright Office allows you to cluster your registrations. So long as the work is either unpublished or, if published, all works were created in the same calendar year and published together or unpublished. You can cluster them all under one application. So you could have a zillion images under one application.
So would publishing in this case be analogous to exhibiting?
And absolute publishing is defined in the statute, section 101 defines publication as any distribution of copies, and copies includes the original, to the public by any means. Or there's an old case which says an unrestricted public display would also be defined as publication. That case actually involved a museum where they exhibited works of art, and they did not have a rule on copying. They allowed people to take photos and make copies of the work that was on display. The court held that that was a publication because they allowed the unrestricted exhibition and people were permitted to copy. So that's publication is a technical term. It doesn't mean publishing in a book or a magazine like you would think. It's a technical term or what we call a defined term, and it's either defined in the statute or by some case law. So if you have work which is not published, and we have clients who, for example, artists who will paint, paint, paint starting New Year's, and they keep painting, and then they get ready for their June show. So by June, they have a whole slew of work, a whole suite of work. We register that collection. You take a photo of it, and you only need one photo if it's unpublished. You register the copyright in that work, and now they take it to the show, and it's registered. The law also says, it's rather interesting, the law gives you a three-month safe harbor. If you register the copyright in work within 3 months of first publication, the registration is considered to be retroactive back to the date of first publication. So if you publish today, you have 3 months from today within which to register your work, and the registration will be deemed to be retroactive back to the date of first publication. Now, a question you raise is an interesting one, and let me tell you a problem. When a copyright case arises, there is a 3-year statute of limitations. That is to say, you must sue for infringement within 3 years of the date of the infringement, or you're forever barred. And we often have clients who come to us very close to the end of the 3 years. They've been wrestling with this. They finally decided or finally learned of the problem, and now they want to file suit. The turnaround time for an application with the Copyright Office is about 6 months. If you file an application today, it takes them 6 months before they'll turn the application around. And if somebody comes to us within a month of the statute of limitations running, we have a problem. The Copyright Office, however, will expedite your registration and actually register within 2 weeks of the date you file it. But for that, they charge an additional $600 and some odd. Because they realize that when you come to them to expedite, you're in trouble. And they take advantage of that. So, you had a question?
No. I was just I'm marveling at the federal government here.
Well, you're dealing with the federal government, which needs money to do whatever it does. The copyright law itself says that copyright protects works of authorship. Works of authorship is defined as basically including art, literature, music, today software, aesthetics. That is to say, copyright does not protect mechanical or functional things. If a work is mechanical or functional, it's protectable, if at all, under the patent laws of the United States, not the copyright laws. And there's a whole body of case law trying to define the difference between art and things which are protectable, works of authorship, and things which are mechanical or useful and not. The leading case is a very famous case. It's called Mazur against Stein. It came down in the 50s. And that case, the United States Supreme Court basically was challenged by the following situation. Somebody took a bronze sculpture of a Balinese dancer, drilled a hole in it, and made it into a lamp. They sought to register the copyright in this creation. the United States Supreme Court held that the sculpture of the Balinese dancer, the artistic portion, is copyright protectable. But the mechanical feature, i.e., converting it into a lamp, is not. And the court came up with a rule. If you can separate the aesthetic sculpture from the functional lamp, the aesthetic is protectable as copyright, the functional is not. And that has become the touchstone of the cases, and there are a bunch of cases on this. For example, you've seen kids' slippers that are made into animals, and they've tried to register copyright in that, and the animal portion is protectable, but the slipper portion is not. And you've seen lamps. There was a case, Esquire versus Ringer, in which a lamp, during the day it looked like a very contemporary sculpture. At night it lit up. And they said, well, the contemporary sculpture is protected as a copyright, but the fact that it's a lamp, that's not copyrightable. And those issues...
Go ahead. So something like wearable art, people who do one-of-a-kind jackets, for example.
Yeah, that's a very good question, because that is a problem. Wearable art, unfortunately, is not copyrightable. The garments are not copyrightable. There's a bill pending in Congress, and this is but not the first time it's actually been introduced, which would create copyright protection for wearable art, for garment design.
And what about things like jewelry?
Jewelry is protectable. Jewelry is protectable, expressly protectable, as sculptural. But there's a case, there's an interesting case, Kitzelstein Kors versus Stein. In that case, the Kitzelstein Kors case, it's a very interesting case. There was a very famous jeweler, Kitzelstein Kors, who took very simple, elegant designs, geometric designs, and he would make them into belt buckles or necklaces. In that case, the lower court said, well, it's really functional. It's a belt buckle. It's not copyrightable. The appellate court said, no, it's conceptually separable from, that you can separate the hooks and loops from the sculptural features. So it is protectable. But that case pointed out what you want to do with something like a belt buckle or a piece that is sculptural and then made into something like cufflinks or a ring or the like. What we have advised our clients who do this kind of work is register the sculptural feature first so you have a sculpture. Then add the hooks and loops and other things on afterwards. Then you don't have any question but that it's protected as a copyrighted sculpture. But that is going to be an issue.
You mean physically take... copyright it before you added physically the
register the copyright in it before you add the other parts, exactly.
Before you add the mechanical elements.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, that's the safest way to go. That way you don't have any question and the copyright office doesn't raise any issue. But that is a problem. And there are lots of cases in which this comes up. By the way, when I say wearable art is not protectable, that's only true in some sense. Let me explain. Fabric design, the designs you see on fabric itself, those designs are protectable. The Peter Pan fabric case says that.
So if you submitted drawings of the designs, you could copyright that.
Of the fabric.
Uh-huh.
Of the designs on the fabric, that's protectable.
Or the fabric itself.
Yes, the fabric itself, the design on the fabric is protectable. In addition, if you have copyrightable features on the garment, for example, if you have a jacket and you have some embroidered pattern on it of a picture, that embroidered picture certainly could be protected as under the copyright law. But the design of the garment itself is not protectable. That's one of the reasons, unfortunately, that as soon as a new garment design hits the market, it's knocked off within minutes. And that's why the designers get their, they secretly create all of their designs, they secretly get them ready for market, and then they launch, and once they launch, the knockoffs are out there.
Right.
They're lobbying now to try and get that changed.
So, so in some respects, an artist is really only protected at this level by the reputation and their name.
Well, and that takes us to really the next point I was going to make. One of the things that an artist has, one of the things an artist has is the skill in their work. That certainly gives them protection. But they also have protection in their name. Any name, symbol, logo, or combination of names, symbols, and logos used in connection with a product or service is protectable not under copyright law, but rather under the trademark laws of the United States and every state. Every country has its own trademark law, and trademark, unlike copyright, does not have any multinational treaties that give reciprocal rights. There is a treaty that came out about 3 years ago called the Madrid Accord. Now, under the Madrid Accord, it is a multinational treaty, but it's a different kind of treaty. It basically says member nations, and there are now close to 50 member nations, can have registrations in other member nations through the trademark office in their own country, but they still have to register country by country. Now, under the EEOC, European Union, there is a pan-European registration, but only for members of the European community. Not, we are not a party to that. We are not members of that union. So we do not have a PAN registration. What we do have is, if I want to register the trademark in the United States and in France and Germany, and which other countries did you say you have representatives from?
Oh, goodness, I'm going to have to go back and look at my list. Australia.
Well, Australia. Yeah, and if I want to register in those countries, I check and see whether they are part of this treaty, and the ones you've listed are, and I can register the trademark in those countries through the United States Trademark Office, the USPTO is what we call it. So I can use a United States trademark lawyer to assist in registering the trademark, but it has to be registered in each country in which you want protection. Interestingly enough, Canada is not a party to that treaty. So if you want to register in Canada, you actually have to go and get a Canadian lawyer to assist you in registering.
Hmm.
Our northern neighbor is not a party to that particular treaty. So you could protect your trademark, and lots of famous artists have. Picasso has a registered trademark. Dale Chihuly has a registered trademark. There are a number of famous artists who have registered trademarks, and that protects the use of their name in connection with their artwork, that's a product, or the service, and that would be the selling of that artwork or the exhibiting of that artwork. And registering your trademark is pretty important. The registration of a trademark, by the way, is identified differently than copyright. When an application is filed, the attorney doing this will use the designation TM, trademark, or SM for service mark. That has no official status, but it is you or your attorney giving notice to the world that you are claiming that the mark is your property and it's protected. So you're giving fair notice, so nobody can say we inadvertently copied it not knowing it was protected. If you register the mark federally, and only if it's registered federally, you may use the little R in a circle. Improper use of the R in a circle can deny you registration and is unlawful. So the only time you can use a little R in a circle is if you have a federally registered trademark. There are, by the way, 34 international categories for goods and 12 categories for services. But the category your most of your listeners would be interested in would be goods in artwork. and services for selling art.
So you are you saying that you actually need a trademark in each category?
No, no. You would only register in the categories you're in. You wouldn't register in every category.
No, you need one for goods and for services?
If you really want to. If you're engaged in the sale of a professional sale to the public of art, like a dealer, you might have a trademark for a gallery. But an artist need not have both. An artist would only have it on the goods.
Okay.
And you've also seen logos. For example, Whistler had the logo, the little butterfly was Whistler's logo. That would be his mark. And it's not uncommon for artists to have a logo in lieu of an actual name. But you could have either or both. And trademarks have value. Trademarks have value. In fact, the president of Nike, Phil Knight, a few years ago in his annual report, said the most valuable asset Nike, the running shoe manufacturer and sports manufacturer, the most valuable asset they have is their trademark. And I agree, because there are a number of stores and companies out there selling and manufacturing running shoes and sports equipment, but it's only the Nike swoosh and the Nike name that establishes the quality of that particular product. Trademark law, unlike copyright law, is really for consumers' protection. By that I mean the purpose of the trademark law is to provide consumers, the people who buy your work, with assurance that when they buy work bearing your name or your logo, they're getting your quality work, work that was really created by you and your quality, and not getting some cheap knockoff. And that's why the trademark laws are there, basically to protect the consumers. You're indirectly protected by giving you the ability to prevent somebody from copying your name or logo, but the consumer is being protected. It's a good idea to register your trademark. There you really do need the assistance of an attorney. It's fairly technical. It takes anywhere from a year to 18 months to get a federal registration, and the trademark examiners are pretty careful. Trademark gives you a monopoly. Unlike copyright, which gives you the right to prevent others from copying, it's a mere right to prevent copying. That's a copyright. Trademark gives you a monopoly. You can prevent others from using your mark or anything which is confusingly similar to your mark. And the law gives you that protection. For that reason, before you can even apply for registration, you should do a search to see that the mark is available and that you're not infringing somebody else's mark. And that search is not only of registered marks, which you can find on the USPTO.gov. Those are all the registered marks up there, but you need to do a common law search, what we call a common law search, that is to see that even unregistered marks, people who are using trademarks but they haven't yet registered them, are not conflicting with yours, because you have to represent to the trademark office that you have the exclusive right to this mark when you apply for registration. Then you apply. The fee for applying, if you apply online, and the trademark office is technologically more savvy right now than the copyright office. Copyright office is talking about allowing online registration, but it hasn't happened yet. Trademark office encourages it. They actually give you a discount if you apply for registration online. They charge $235 as a registration fee, a filing fee, if you apply online. If you apply using a paper application, they charge you significantly more. Once you apply, it takes, as I said, about a year to 18 months before the certificate of registration will issue. During that time, however, you are noted on the registry as having an application pending, and you're giving notoriety to the world that you're claiming the property right in and to that mark. The mark is pretty important because not only would you use it on your artwork, but you would use it in connection with any other expanded applications of your art as well. For example, once you are recognized, you would probably want to put your mark on T-shirts. You'd probably want to put your mark on books, et cetera, et cetera. I think I'm about out of time. I apologize. I wish I had a week to do this. When I taught this field of art law as a law professor, I used to have 15 weeks at 3 hours a week to teach my law students, and I could use about that time now, and even then I would run out of time before I ran out of material. I would suggest, though, for your listeners, if they want more information, I'd certainly be willing to talk to them, or if they send me an email, I will try and respond. But there's a book called Art, Law in a Nutshell. It's published by the West Publishing Group. It covers, it's a survey of the field, and in fact, the Register of Copyright, the woman who is head of the United States Copyright Office, Mary Beth Peters, was kind enough to write the introduction to that book. And that's a good book to get a feeling for and a survey of the field of art law. Let me thank you for allowing me to visit with all of your listeners, and hope you all do well in your field.
Thank you so much, Leonard. We are so much more enlightened. It was great having you join SmartUS this year, and I really appreciate it knowing your schedule.
Thanks very much. Have a great day.
Take care of yourself today.
Thanks.
Okay, artists, that brings us to the end of our fifth day of SmartUS keynote presentations with Molly Gordon, Allison Stanfield, and attorney Leonard DeBoff. If you are finding value in your experience with SmartUS, why not take a moment to tell us? You can jump in on the SmartWork 2008 forum, or you can email me at info@smartus-telesummit.com, and you can find out what we're doing at www.smartus-telesummit.com. Smartist again, S-M-Artist, A-R-T-I-S-T. See everyone tomorrow, Thursday, January 24th, when we'll be starting 45 minutes earlier than today. We'll have Claudine Helmuth and Michael Bungie Stanier, same bridge line, different experts, all ready to help you balance your life and sell your art. Until tomorrow, this is Ariane, your host and moderator for SmartUS, signing off for today. Goodbye.